Think on your feet for our Fast and Curious 5K, a one-of-a-kind race hosted by WBEZ and the Chicago Sun-Times on Saturday, July 27th at Humboldt Park. More info and early bird registration at wbez.org/events.
This WBEZ podcast is supported by Ravinia, with over 100 concerts under the stars this summer, including Daryl Hall and Elvis Costello, Norah Jones with special guest Mavis Staples, The Beach Boys with special guest John Stamos, Shaggy and TLC, Jason Isbell and the 400 Unit, the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, and more. Their 30-acre park is nestled in a gently wooded area. Bring your own picnic or eat at one of the park restaurants. Tickets available now only at ravinia.org.
I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset. We're listening to Sea Jam Blues, one of Duke Ellington's more than 1,000 compositions. This particular rendition is performed by the Jazz at Lincoln Center Orchestra, featuring the legendary Wynton Marsalis. Marsalis, who is a 9-time Grammy Award winner, recently performed with the very same orchestra for the 30th season of the Symphony Center Presents Jazz series. The concert boasts a collection of Ellington's work, right in time for the 125th anniversary of his birthday. Marsalis, the JLCO, and the CSO performed a jazz meets classical event, along with selected works from Ellington earlier this week. I sat down with the accomplished Wynton Marsalis for more on how he got his start as a jazz musician.
I think, yeah, just my generation and time, to have a parent that played the music was one of the only ways you would know what it was. So I was fortunate. My dad was a modern jazz musician, so he really struggled in New Orleans. So I spent a lot of my time on their gigs in clubs with very few people.
Yeah.
But because I related to the musicians, their intelligence and their concerns, I was always hearing them talk as the only kid, like in a club. Of adults, and when I became 12, I became interested in listening to the music, like listening to John Coltrane, to Miles, and to a lot of the different musicians, Freddie Hubbard.
And then, when did you pick up the trumpet?
I first got a trumpet when I was 6.
But that's early.
Believe me, it stayed early for a long time. So I still sounded like I was 6 when I was 12. But being around musicians, I was able to, I know what to practice and have really good teachers. My father was also an educator. So just being in his presence was an education.
Mm. I hear one of your first experiences performing, this was when you were about 8 years old. For those who don't know, tell us, what was the Fairview Baptist Church Band?
It was a band formed by a great banjoist, Danny Barker, who had played with Louis Armstrong, Cab Calloway. And he got all the kids together post-civil rights movement, after Martin Luther King was assassinated, and he said, it's important for us to keep this tradition going.
So yeah.
It was a band of all younger musicians.
Wow. So a childhood with deep roots in jazz, but you eventually found your way to classical music, Wynton. You attended the Juilliard School, studying classical, and full circle, you are now the director of jazz studies there at the school. Talk about having that foot in each of those worlds, classical music as well as jazz.
Well, they weren't worlds for me so much just because of the way my father listened to music and knew about it and encouraged us to study
music. So did they intersect more?
Yeah, we went to our arts high school. It had both classical music and jazz, and we had a great theory teacher. And my father was the jazz instructor. And Terrence Blanchard's a great trumpet player and composer. He would actually accompany me on the piano when I would play like Haydn trumpet concerto. And he also played trumpet in the jazz band. So we had a certain culture at that time of seriousness and of excellence. And I was fortunate to be in that time. And the Chicago Symphony, for trumpet players, the first trumpeter at that time was a guy named Adolf Herseth.
Okay.
And he was in the chair for many years, but he defined orchestral trumpet playing in the world for a long time.
So at least was the goal to get in that chair?
It wasn't my goal, but I loved his playing.
Yeah.
I mean, his sound and his approach. And then, of course, I had a chance to meet him, and he would come to some of our concerts. He was such an idol of all the trumpet players in the 1970s, 80s, into the 90s. I mean, one of his final concert here, I attended. It was Mahler's First Symphony.
Mm.
And he just could, the whole concept of the Chicago Symphony brass section at that time, the tuba player Arnold Jacobs had a breathing method that everybody, Dale Clevenger was the first horn, And their brass section was famous for all brass players.
Interesting.
So I grew up listening to them and their recordings of all the big brass pieces, whatever, Pines of Rome, Mahler, all the Mahler symphonies. That's great for
trumpet. That was the inspiration.
Well, part of the inspiration to learn how to play certainly was Herseth.
Time to listen to some more music. This is a throwback to when you toured with Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers. This is one of my favorite melodies of all time. Here's My Funny Valentine from a 1980 performance. So I did some reading to catch up on your career, and I was floored by the actual number of legends that you have played with. I mean, I knew there were a lot, but I mean, Art Blakey, of course, Sarah Vaughan, Dizzy Gillespie, John Lewis, Herbie Hancock, and many, many more. I mean, what was the best piece of advice, if you had to think back, that you received from these pillars of jazz? Maybe something that you now continue to pass on to new musicians in the game.
I mean, I guess there's so many, but with Sarah Vaughan, just the importance of thoroughness. Like I was playing a tune on the piano, Duke Ellington's song, Tonight I Shall Sleep With a Smile on My Face. I mean, I thought, how many people have ever heard of this song?
Tonight I shall sleep with a smile on my face, dreaming.
So I was showing off for her, but I didn't know one section of the songs. It's an obscure song from the 1940s. She sat down at the piano, and I didn't know that her piano playing skills were. She was a piano player.
Yeah.
So she sat down at the piano. She said, "You're not playing the changes right, baby." She started playing unbelievable piano. She played the whole song straight through all the, and it's involved. And when she finished, she said, "Learn songs off the record and learn them completely. Be thorough in everything that you do." And then she played the right changes. She said, "These are the changes." Yes, ma'am.
Wow. Be thorough in everything that you do. I feel like that's a lesson for us all.
Yeah, just to be for real. And if you'd have heard her playing piano, I thought to myself, man, she plays piano like that and sang?
Like, mind-blowing, right?
So, yeah, it was actually the level of the virtuosity of her piano playing.
WBEZ is supported by Chicago Humanities, presenting live events with historians Doris Kearns Goodwin and John Meacham, comedian Reggie Watts and filmmaker Miranda July, and artists Hebrew Brantley and Amanda Williams in conversation. Plus, MSNBC chief correspondent Ali Velshi on small yet powerful acts of courage throughout history. Tickets for these events and more conversations on arts, culture, and current affairs at chicagohumanities.org. This WBEZ podcast is supported by the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. Suicide is a topic that hides in the shadows. It's time we talk away the dark, learn how to spot the warning signs for suicide, and how you can have an open, caring, real conversation to help save lives. Visit the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention to watch the new short film and learn more at afsp.org/talkawaythedark.
In 1991, you became the artistic director of the JLCO, or the Jazz at Lincoln Center Orchestra. Let's listen to Second Line from the group's 1992 album, Portraits by Ellington. Thank you. I want to get into the legendary Duke Ellington for just a bit. Tell us your first exposure to his work. Do you remember?
Well, my father had his records, but I had the chance to go hear them at the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival in 1971 when I was 9. And my father said, hey, man, you want to go hear Duke? I said, no, man. I don't want to hear Duke.
No interest.
I'll play some street football. So he let me stay home. So that's the first. I always tell that story, and I tell people, don't ask your kids what they want to do. Make them go and then make them pretend like they like it. And we didn't really listen to big band music that much in my time. The 70s, more fusion and funk and pop music.
Yeah.
So I listened to Duke's music a little bit, but I didn't really like it. I didn't have the taste for big band music. Then when I left New Orleans, I got the Smithsonian collection of jazz. And they had some of Duke Ellington's pieces. I didn't know that any jazz musician had written pieces that were that sophisticated in terms of the composition. I knew, of course, about improvisation.
Yeah.
It was a piece called Bragging in Brass from 1938. Man, somebody was writing something like that. 1938, that sophisticated. So then I started to research like really bad reviews Duke got for writing Black, Brown, and Beige. And knowing that for jazz musicians, that meant it was good. So I started listening to it. And I got addicted to his music, just the sophistication of it and the range and the brilliance of it, the originality, the harmonic, just the genius of it, the thematic cohesiveness of his music. And having listened to a lot of classical music, I was used to listening to long music and analyzing it and was interested in music with a development section. So then to listen to the Sweet Such Sweet Thunder, my father had that album of his tonal portraits of characters in Shakespeare, where he wrote a sonnet in music with the same as the literary form, and on and on and on. Duke's world is endless. There's really over 2,000 compositions and 800 albums.
Oh, wow.
And each decade of Ellington is something completely different. I mean, his only equivalent in Western music is Bach.
Mm-hmm.
And Bach had to write a mass every Sunday. So he was forced by the nature of his job for the duration of that
job. To write as much as he did.
To write, whereas Duke was on the road writing, you know, that much music.
That's it's incredible, especially for that time.
Yeah, well, it's any time. You know, 800 records. I don't care what time
lot.
You in.
That's
2,000 pieces, you pick the time.
That is a lot.
You're going to find a lot of other stuff to do than that.
Well, he left such an impression on you that you wrote an article in 1999 for the New York Times that was celebrating the centennial of Ellington's birth. Here's a little quote from what you wrote. You said, Duke understood that music could be called upon to evoke diverse aspects of our national character. And he drew on the musical personalities of his band members to create a particular American tapestry of mood and style.
Right.
And at the end of the article, you write, quote, I've always regarded the Duke Ellington Orchestra as one of the great achievements in the history of art.
Yeah, no question.
Expand on that for me.
Well, he was the American bard of the 20th century. Walt Whitman was the bard of the 19th century. And just to achieve that originality of timbre, harmony, to understand the implications of the blues with that type of depth, to interpret folk material and to use the American popular song like folk material, to the type of mastery of form and understanding and insight into the nature of the people that he came from.
Mm.
And with Duke, you find all types of regional music, He liked to use the word, the phrase, beyond category. And really, the man's world was endless. He worked with so many people. He recorded, and the musicians loved him. And the type of generosity of spirit that he exhibited and he exemplified, and the dedication to his grave, he was still writing unbelievable pieces. Beyond whatever styles, some pop styles came in, he continued to keep. He did not get distracted by any noise that came from the academy or from the street.
So as a band leader yourself, are you trying at all to embody a Duke Ellington style or parts of his style?
Yes, always. I try to embody the best of any of the things that I know about. But at this point, I mean, I've been doing it for 40-something years, so it's I admire and love and respect him and his achievements And many of the other, Count Basie had another style, but was just as not a composer, of course, not prolific like Duke, but just as dedicated and as much an embodiment of the spirit of our music. I believe in maintaining the spirit of our music and the way that we do things, with the kind of insistence on a personal engagement, the familial feeling, and we have our own way of formality.
Yeah,
we have our own way of dealing with each other, our own type of humanity and of expression, our own soul and feeling, and that is what we maintain. Not just me and members of our orchestra, we're very well aware of it, and we do, we maintain our way of life and being in a very deliberate way.
Yeah. 40-something years of doing this. I mean, do you ever feel like you need to reinvent the wheel at all or keep things fresh?
No, the wheel is always fresh. Just think, if we got rid of all the wheels, I wouldn't have got here today.
As I mentioned earlier, you and the JLCO, you're performing with the CSO. The press release for this event says it will be a, quote, jazz meets classical event, which sounds right up your alley, as we've talked about. Tell me a bit about Giancarlo Guerrero, who's the conductor.
You know, this is our first time performing with him, so we're gonna meet each other and know each other, and we're gonna get into it.
The performance will feature compositions from Sergei Prokofiev's Romeo and Juliet, John Adams, Dmitri Shostakovich, Duke Ellington, and you. So tell me, what's the connective tissue here? What do all these pieces have in common?
Well, you know, they have many things in common. Romeo and Juliet is a ballet, is dance music, it's a suite. We're taking certain pieces from it. So jazz is dance music. John Adams loved Duke Ellington, so it was one of his influences when he was growing up. Shostakovich was under the thumb of Stalin, and he was no stranger to very deep oppression. And he's such a heroic composer, and he endured so much. I mean, who of the composers can say they were poorly reviewed for one of their pieces by the dictator of a country who killed millions of its citizens? And he still lived in terror. He's such a genius as a composer. Prokofiev, most people know from Peter and the Wolf, and he was not under the same yoke that Shostakovich was under, but fantastic composer. The Russian tradition has a lot in common with the American tradition. It's the very strong folk melodies and the kind of dance, bottom bass, the tendency toward a darkness of mood, the use of brass instruments for punctuation, and something in the character, same kind of similar sense of humor.
Yeah.
So there are relationships. Matter of fact, if the chairman dances in a premiere with the Milwaukee Symphony of John Adams's piece, the conductor, Lucas Foss, I played under him in the Brooklyn Philharmonic when I played with them in 1980. Oh. So when you look underneath things, we have a lot of connections.
So many.
We all have. But Shostakovich is an unbelievable hero, you know. He's another composer that wrote great for trumpet. I played Prokofiev's Fifth Symphony under Leonard Bernstein at Tanglewood in 1979. And Shostakovich's Piano Concerto is one of the first trumpet parts you learn. It's just a great part to play. And Shostakovich remains a hero of mine. And
nice.
Anybody who embraces freedom can understand and relate to what Shostakovich dealt with. For those who don't listen to his music, the Seventh Symphony has a story to it that everybody likes the story.
Yeah.
You know, it's a good symphony, a good way to get into his music. But it's all great.
That's wonderful.
And, you know, this piece is for, it's a suite for variety orchestra. So it's kind of like circus music and band music and waltzes and all the things that jazz and classical music have in common in its folk root.
Yeah, I see. You know? Well, before we go, I want to listen to a bit of All American Pep, the composition of yours that the Jazz at Lincoln Center Orchestra will be performing this evening.
Yeah.
Love the rhythm.
That's Charleston.
That this piece has the texture to it.
Well, that's a Charleston rhythm, but it's turned on the other sides of the beat. So Charleston was just Charleston, dit dit. So I go dit dit, oh oh, dit dit, dut dut. I just take the one rhythm
okay.
and play around with it and put it on different parts of the beat. And then trick drums, like what they would do in the time of the Charleston dance and all these different things that are...
That are. It sounds incredible. I mean, you took inspiration, I think, from composers like Gershwin, Bernstein, and Ellington.
Well, it's less from their music than it is from the American, the overall American thematic material of that time.
Capturing that American optimism.
It's our thing, yeah, and it's also in the 20s. But it's also affected by a song like Sleigh Ride, which comes from another time. Sleigh Ride is a piece, Leroy Anderson, that elementary school bands play, pops orchestras play, and symphonic orchestras play. You know, that's a fantastic piece of American music because so many ensembles can play it.
Yeah.
And it doesn't lose its integrity. And the trumpets get to sound like horses. So if you grew up, you play that piece, you always wait for the school band. The one concert your brothers and sisters' parents went to.
Oh, I missed my days in the school band.
What did you play? What did you play?
I'm so glad you asked. I played the clarinet.
Oh. So you always turn around asking us to play softer.
Yes. You were a little loud back there. You brass people.
Terrorizing us.
So if listeners want to hear this piece performed live, head over to the CSO. I mean, give us some final thoughts, Winton. I mean, are you looking forward to the show? I mean, you've performed all over the world. You keep coming back to Chicago. What is it about this city?
Well, I love the symphony and the symphony hall, and we have a long tradition. I told you about how I grew up listening to CSO. So we have a long tradition of playing in the hall. I don't even want to say how many years it is, but we love coming. It's like a second home for us. And Jim Fahey has been there for so many years. We look at each other every year and say, are we still doing this? So,
yes, you are.
1 year we played when the Bears beat the Saints, and we had to sit and face the humiliation of you all playing the symphony, playing the Bears fight song. We said if we won, we were going to play the Saints, and of course we lost. Mm-hmm. So we have a long tradition, and it's filled with love and good feeling.
Well, looking forward to it. That's Winton Marsalis, Grammy Award winning trumpeter and composer. Such a pleasure, Winton. Thank you again.
Hey, it's my pleasure. Thank you, Sasha.
This episode of the Reset Podcast was produced and mixed by Ethan Schwab. It was edited by me. If you like this conversation with the jazz legend, there is still time to catch Winton Marsalis this evening at the Symphony Center. You can find tickets at cso.org. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. Thank you for listening.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.